This is Audible.
Welcome. You are about to embark on a unique learning adventure from the Great Courses. Our courses are crafted to be entertaining journeys, both comprehensive and fascinating. They're designed to expand horizons, deepen understanding, and foster epiphanies in a broad array of subjects and university-level disciplines. The lecturers are university professors and subject matter experts carefully selected by the Great Courses and its customers for their intellectual distinction and exceptional abilities to teach. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalogs or visit our website at thegreatcourses.com and imagine how much you can learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the company of some of the greatest minds in the world. These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. These lectures are titled, The Celtic World. Your lecturer is Jennifer Paxton. Dr. Paxton is the director of the University Honors Program and a clinical assistant professor of history at the Catholic University of America. She received her doctorate in history from Harvard University, where she has also taught and earned a certificate of distinction in teaching. Dr. Paxton lectures regularly at the Smithsonian Institution and serves as a study leader to Scotland and Ireland for Smithsonian journeys. Her research focuses on England from the reign of King Alfred to the late 12th century. Lecture 1. Who are the Celts?
Welcome to this course on the Celtic world. Let me begin right away with two paired scenes of triumph and defeat that define the sweep of Celtic history. Let's start with a pair of ancient scenes, beginning with the triumphant one. It's 390 BC. The ferocious Gaulish tribesmen of northern Italy have defeated the Roman army just outside the city of Rome. As the Gauls enter the city, they come upon the elderly Roman patricians sitting stoically unmoving on their ivory chairs outside their houses, bravely awaiting their fate. At first, the Gauls think they are statues of gods. But once they realize that they are only men, they savagely slaughter them all. The Gauls have humbled the most powerful city in Italy, the future seat of a world empire. Now the scene of Celtic defeat. It's 46 BC, shortly after Julius Caesar has brought Gaul, which is now France, under Roman control. After uniting the tribes of Gaul against Caesar, the great Gaulish rebel leader Vercingetorix has made a last, unsuccessful stand against the power of Rome. After 5 years of captivity, at the moment of Caesar's choosing, Vercingetorix is led off to Rome to be exhibited in a triumphal parade and then ritually strangled. The Gaulish threat to Rome is ended once and for all. Now let's fast forward many centuries in time and transport ourselves from the heart of the continent of Europe to its very periphery, the island of Ireland. This time we will start with a scene of Celtic defeat. It is April 1603. Hugh O'Neill is the leader of the most dangerous rebellion against English rule in Ireland since the arrival of the first English colonists in the 12th century. But after losing a key battle in the south of Ireland, he has been hiding out on his northern estates. He knows Queen Elizabeth I is close to death, but he would prefer to wait and make peace with her successor, the future James I, who he thinks will give him a better deal. Finally, O'Neill cannot hold out any longer, and he submits. Only afterwards does he discover that he has been tricked by the English Lord Deputy Mountjoy, who has concealed news of the Queen's death until after O'Neill has made his submission. The English government slowly undermines his traditional rights as an Irish chieftain until, 4 years later, he feels driven to go into exile alongside several other Irish lords. This so-called flight of the earls marks the effective end of native rule in Ireland and the beginning of a long period of repression and marginalization for the native Irish, during which time the Irish language declines, along with many other aspects of traditional Irish culture. Now the scene of triumph. It is May 2011. A different Queen Elizabeth is on a state visit to the Republic of Ireland. She visits the graves of Irish patriots who had rebelled against British rule and leaves a floral tribute. She makes a speech in which she alludes to the troubled past relationship between Britain and Ireland with regret. And, to the astonishment and delight of her audience, she begins her speech with a couple of words in the Irish language. So, we have two encounters between Celtic peoples and their much more powerful adversaries. The first began in triumph and ended in defeat, while the second began in defeat and ended in reconciliation. Though, of course, the story continues. These encounters will form a large part of this course on the Celtic world. We will learn about the fascinating story of the ancient Celts who roamed across Europe and terrified the Romans and the Greeks, but who also created one of the most captivating art styles the world has ever seen. We will also tell the story of the Celtic Fringe, a region on the extreme edge of Western Europe, where the people created and preserved traditions in art, music, and literature that influenced modern culture around the world. These Celtic areas have been defined in various ways over time, but to give them their most expansive definition, they include the whole of the island of Ireland and the western parts of Britain, especially Scotland, Wales, and Cornwall in the southwest, and also including the Isle of Man in the Irish Sea between Ireland and Britain. But the Celtic realms also include Brittany in western France, and by some definitions, they include the northwestern parts of Spain, especially Galicia. So we've got two stories to tell, the story that takes place in the heart of Europe and the story that takes place on the periphery of Europe. And we're going to explore the connection between these two phenomena, the fierce warriors of the continent who gave the Romans a run for their money, and the residents of Ireland and the other Celtic realms who kept ancient traditions alive in the face of relentless pressure from centralizing monarchies, especially England and France. How are these two stories related? The answer used to be simple, but it has become more complicated, as we will see in a moment. This course will also tell the story of how those traditions were spread around the world by emigrants from the Celtic realms. Some of these phenomena are readily recognizable as Celtic in origin. The shamrock, the Celtic cross, the mischievous leprechaun and his pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, the banshee who wails mysteriously to signal a death, the Highland bagpipe and the tartan, among many others. As we will see in later lectures, some of these supposedly Celtic traditions have been transformed in ways that their originators would not recognize. Still, most people can easily identify them as Irish or Scottish. We will tell the story of all of these phenomena in this course. But some elements of Celtic tradition and vocabulary have been incorporated into modern Western cultures so thoroughly that many people are not even aware of the Celtic origins of certain words and customs. For instance, many words have come into English from the Irish language, which is sometimes referred to outside of Ireland as Gaelic. Here are just a few that most people don't even recognize as having an Irish origin. When you call someone a phony, you are using an Irish word. When you smash something into smithereens, you are also using an Irish word. When you carve a jack-o'-lantern on Halloween and put a candle in it, you are also following an ancient Irish custom, though the Irish originally used turnips, not pumpkins. So the Celtic phenomenon is woven into our lives, and it's a fascinating story. In order to tell it, this course is going to cover nearly 3,000 years of history, and it will range from almost every part of Europe to Britain and Ireland to the New World and beyond, because the Celts have become a worldwide phenomenon. The art and music and literature of the Celts have never been more popular. For many people, Celtic culture really means Irish culture. Irish culture has, of course, been spread around the globe by the Irish diaspora, the many millions of people who trace their descent to the island of Ireland. But many of the people who find themselves fascinated by Irish culture cannot, in fact, claim any actual Irish heritage. They just like Irish music and dancing. Think of the enormous success of the Irish dancing show Riverdance, or the popularity of singers such as Enya, who draw on traditional Irish dance steps and musical traditions, respectively. Irish writers have also made a huge impact on the world. No fewer than 4 Irish authors have won Nobel Prizes for Literature, a remarkable achievement, considering that the entire population of Ireland is only about 7 million, less than 1% of the population of Europe. Celtic art styles have also become popular around the world. The dense, abstract patterns familiar from the medieval Irish manuscript, the Book of Kells, can now be found on everything, from tea towels to t-shirts to tattoos. The reach of Irish culture, of course, extends beyond the realm of the fine arts. There are Irish pubs in every corner of the globe, from Hong Kong to Buenos Aires, and St. Patrick's Day parades can be found almost everywhere. Millions and millions of people take pleasure in wearing green and declaring themselves Irish for a day. But there is a major paradox at the heart of the Celtic craze. The Celtic realms themselves are tiny. The island of Ireland itself, which contains 2 political entities, the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland, which is part of the United Kingdom, has a population of less than 7 million. In total, the areas that identify themselves now as part of the Celtic world, what some people call the Celtic fringe, have a combined population of only around 20 million people. So how did the Celtic phenomenon spread so far and wide? Why are so many people fascinated with the Celts? That is one of the main questions we will try to answer in this course. Let me start by asking what seems like a simple question. Who are these Celts who have had such a huge impact on modern culture around the world? The answer to this question used to be very straightforward. I'm going to lay out what we thought we knew about the Celts when I first started studying them in the 1980s. It's the story of an aggressive and warlike people who gave one of the most powerful empires in European history a run for its money. According to the story I learned, the Celts are a people who arose in Central Europe in the middle of the first millennium BC. There, they created a culture that produced a particular art style that focused on beautiful abstract patterns and stylized animals. But besides being artists, they were also dedicated warriors, determined to win glory in battle. The Celts spread out from their Central European homelands throughout Europe. When they campaigned to the south and the east, they clashed with the Romans and the Greeks, who wrote the first descriptions we have of them, some of which are truly blood-curdling. In addition to sacking the city of Rome in 390 BC, the Celts desecrated the shrine of Delphi in Greece, the home of the famous oracle, in 279 BC, and afterwards established themselves in central Anatolia, which is now Turkey, becoming the ancestors of the Galatians that we know of from the New Testament. But the Celts also spread west into Gaul and down into Spain. Then, around 200 BC or so, they took to the seas and invaded Britain and Ireland, where they conquered the native inhabitants and established their own culture and language. At one point, then, the Celts dominated most of the continent of Europe, even extending down into northern Italy, where the Romans were hard-pressed to restrain their advances. A map of Europe would show a uniform Celtic hegemony from Ireland to Greece, from Spain to Austria. But then the tide turned against the Celts. Slowly the Romans pushed the Celts back. The Romans conquered Spain first, and then Gaul, and finally Britain, though they never managed to subdue the entire island, and they left the wild north of Britain, which is now Scotland, unconquered. And they never even tried to conquer Ireland. But when the Romans were forced to withdraw from Britain, the Celts took up arms again and bravely fought a series of unsuccessful battles against a new group of invaders, the Anglo-Saxons. The Celts were then driven into the more remote corners of the island of Britain, the beautiful mountainous north and west and southwest, and some of them migrated to western France, to the region now known as Brittany, and even to northern Spain, where some remnants of Celtic populations also survived. These regions on the periphery of Western Europe, along with the entire island of Ireland, became known much later as the Celtic Fringe. Thus, the story goes, only in these remote parts of Britain and in Ireland, plus Brittany and northern Spain, did the original Celtic civilization that had once covered most of Europe managed to survive. Over the centuries, the Celts clung to their cultural autonomy by cultivating their distinctive traditions in music and literature and art. All the while, they progressively came to be dominated by the strong nation-states that arose in England, France, and Spain. The Celtic area suffered from persecution of various kinds as these nation-states tried to impose their own culture, especially their language, on the stubborn Celtic population. These cultural traditions survived underground until they were revived in the 19th century as part of the great wave of nationalism that swept Europe, leading to the successful struggle for Irish independence and the revival of Celtic pride throughout the Celtic world. This version of the history of the Celts, as a people that once ruled Europe, has been enormously influential in the modern world. It is very much the story that I was taught when I first learned about the Celts, but recent scholarship has uncovered evidence that the story is much more complicated and more interesting than we used to think. For one thing, it is becoming clearer and clearer that the definition of Celtic is much harder to pin down than scholars have traditionally believed. The Celts have usually been identified by several key traits, primarily their language, their art, and their social and military customs, as we read about them in the works written about the Celts by Greek and Roman authors. The idea has been that the Celts came with a kind of Celtic cultural package. All Celts spoke Celtic languages, produced Celtic art, and did stereotypically Celtic things, like, for instance, collecting and revering severed human heads. We will talk about that a lot in a later lecture. The idea was that a Celt was a Celt, wherever you might encounter him or her in the far-flung Celtic world. As I said before, today we associate the Celts primarily with Ireland and the British Isles, because that is where the Celtic languages survived the longest. And one of the most important aspects of this Celtic hypothesis is the notion that the residents of the British Isles and Ireland can be identified with the residents of the European continent who battled against the Romans and Greeks. If the Irish and the Welsh are really just the cousins of the Gauls who confronted Julius Caesar, then we are looking at one unified story, of which the Irish and British chapter is just one part. If the Celtic hypothesis is true, then the Irish and the Welsh and the other residents of the Celtic fringe regions can consider themselves part of a story that dates all the way back to the origins of the Celts in Central Europe. The Celts who sacked Rome would be their ancestors. The trouble is, modern scholarship is causing the Celtic hypothesis to unravel. It turns out that the peoples of Ireland and Britain may have had no ethnic connection to the peoples on the continent of Europe. Scholars no longer believe that there was one unified Celtic culture spread by a specific group of people who shared a common genetic descent. Instead, it looks as though the traits we associate with the Celts today, such as their language and their art, may have spread around Europe to various peoples who had no genetic connection to each other. And these characteristics may not have started out in the same place. The art we think of as Celtic may have developed in one part of Europe, while the language we think of as Celtic may have developed in another part of Europe. It is no longer necessarily the case that we can pin one specific set of cultural features to one specific group of people. This new scholarly approach to the Celts flies in the face of centuries of settled beliefs about where the Celts came from and how they spread. Now, something is definitely lost if we abandon the old model. The earlier idea has Celts on the move, conquering Europe, and then surviving against all odds in Ireland and the fringes of Britain. This makes the Celts look extremely powerful, and it gives them a kind of romantic status as the last remnants of a lost civilization. But the problem with the model is that it's probably not true. It turns out that there is very little evidence to support the idea that there ever was a Celtic civilization. If you asked people from different parts of the so-called Celtic world in, say, 200 BC, whether they were Celts, they wouldn't have known what you were talking about. People in Ireland would have had no notion of being part of a unified civilization that extended all the way to the Galatians in Turkey. Now, I know it is somewhat surprising at the start of a course about the Celts to attack the very idea that you can identify the Celts as a unified people. But rest assured, the Celtic phenomenon is even more interesting than the old model would suggest. And we are left with three really fascinating questions that we will try to answer in this course. The first question is, what happened among the disparate peoples who have been identified as Celtic to make them adopt the cultural traits that we associate now with Celticness? In other words, how do cultural identities form in the first place? The second question is, if the Celts were not a unified people, how did this idea of the Celts as a single people arise in the first place? We're going to spend some time in this course telling the story of how the Celts were, in a sense, invented by scholars beginning in the 16th century. At that time, scholars decided that the Celts they were familiar with from Caesar's wars against the Gauls must have been related to the people they were familiar with now in contemporary Ireland, Wales, and Scotland. And the connection stuck. So we're going to learn about how an idea was born, and then how it started to come under stress based on new scholarly work in the late 20th century and beyond. The third question, though, is going to be just as interesting to us, and that is why the culture that came to be associated with the Celts has been so successful around the world. What is it about the music and art and literature of the Celtic realms that has captured the imagination of so many people, even those who have no claim to Celtic ancestry? Is there something that we can identify as a Celtic approach to art, even to life, that speaks to people today? So if we're no longer sure that there is a strong connection between the Celts of the European continent and the inhabitants of the British Isles and Ireland, does that mean that we are going to define the Celts narrowly in this course? By no means. This course will use the most expansive possible definition of the Celtic world. We will tell two interlocking stories. The first story is the story of what actually happened in the areas we now think of as Celtic in some fashion, as we currently understand it. The second story, which is equally fascinating, is the story of how the legend of the Celts developed over time and influenced the politics and society of the Celtic realms in particular, but also of the whole world. To tell these two stories, we will need to discuss several kinds of evidence. Scholars like to talk in terms of evidence, which is simply the material they use to create a picture of what happened in the past. The Celtic story draws on many different academic disciplines or approaches to knowledge. And in many ways, the story of the Celts also allows us to tell a fascinating story of how these disciplines developed. I just want to say a few words as we get started about these different disciplines and where they enter the story of the Celts. We'll have much more to say about all of them in future lectures. So let me say something about these various approaches to knowledge that are going to help us understand the Celtic phenomenon. And I'm going to discuss them roughly in the order in which they developed as distinct methods for approaching a study of the past. Each of them has its own strengths, but also important limitations that we need to be aware of so that we can interpret the evidence in the best possible way. I'm going to start with history, which is my own discipline. The most important method used by historians is the analysis of written texts. We actually have lots of texts written about the ancient Celts, as we'll see in a future lecture, and we can learn a lot about them from the works written by the ancient Romans and Greeks who encountered them. Starting from about the 6th century, the residents of the Celtic fringe themselves wrote an enormous amount of material that we can read and analyze, though some of it is very obscure and difficult to understand. But we have lots and lots of written evidence that we can use to learn about the Celts using traditional methods of textual analysis. Of course, these methods of analysis are very old. Historians have been analyzing written texts for over 2,000 years. But we'll see that the ways in which we analyze texts can change over time. History is a discipline that is always renewing itself. Of course, textual analysis has many drawbacks as well as advantages. We are limited by what remains. There are many things we'd like to know about the past, but if nobody chose to write them down, or if texts that recorded this information were lost, we are out of luck. We are also at the mercy of the biases of those who wrote the texts that do survive. These authors were not necessarily trying to enlighten us on the points about which we have questions. In some cases, we can tell that authors are distorting the past for their own purposes. In other cases, we probably don't even realize this. We're being fooled. But we must proceed bravely anyway. Another discipline that is absolutely essential to understanding the Celts is historical linguistics. This is the study of how languages are related to each other and how they change over time. Languages can be related to each other almost the way members of a family are related to each other, or like branches of a tree. Historical linguists try to determine how closely related to each other different languages are, and this can allow them to make certain hypotheses about the people who spoke them. People who speak closely related languages may have started out living close together, and sometimes the specific words in those languages can tell us something about where the people might have lived in the past. For example, if a language has a lot of words for snow, the people who spoke it probably came originally from an area with cold winters. Historical linguistics is crucial to our story for many reasons. One of the most important is because it is through linguistics that the connection among all of the Celtic peoples was first made, and particularly the connection between the residents of Ireland and Britain and the Celts of the continent, starting in the 16th century. It turned out that the languages spoken in Ireland and Britain were related to the language spoken in Gaul in the time of Julius Caesar. We will have much more to say about this connection later. So it was really historical linguistics that helped create the idea of the Celts as a unified phenomenon in the first place. Since the 1990s, historical linguists have been doing pioneering work in trying to determine whether newly found stone inscriptions from Spain and northern Italy were written in Celtic languages or not. So the work of linguists is crucial to the question of determining who is and is not a Celt, a question to which we will return many times in this course. Linguistics can also tell us some very important things about historical developments. For example, if we understand how the Celtic languages changed over time, we can often tell when a particular important event took place, because of how that event is recorded in the Celtic languages. An important example is the Christianization of Ireland. We know that Ireland started to be Christianized in the 4th century, because we know that certain words about Christianity that were borrowed from Latin into Old Irish would look one way if they were borrowed in the 4th century and another way if they were borrowed in the 6th century, due to the way the language had changed in the meantime. I'll explain how we can know this later. But for now, just keep in mind that the study of the Celtic languages will play a very important role in this story. Finally, of course, historical linguistics is vital, because we need a thorough understanding of the Celtic languages themselves if we are to understand the texts that were written by the people we're trying to study. Here is where the techniques of textual analysis and linguistic analysis intersect. Historians and linguists have to work hand in hand, particularly when studying the Celts. As I said, historical linguistics has been part of the effort to understand the Celts since the 16th century, and as the discipline of linguistics as a whole has advanced, new insights about the Celtic languages are continually coming to light. So like history, linguistics is a relatively old discipline that is still producing new information. Of course, linguistics, like textual analysis, has its own drawbacks. Languages are very complex, and if you're trying to see relationships between languages, it can be easy to focus on the features that look similar and ignore the differences, or vice versa. So caution is required. Another important academic discipline that's vital to the study of the Celts is archaeology, which really developed as an academic discipline starting in the 19th century. If historians concentrate on texts and linguists concentrate on the languages in which those texts were written, archaeologists work without any texts at all. Although, of course, they're happy to draw on texts when they prove helpful. Their work is focused almost entirely on physical artifacts. Academic archaeology grew out of the sort of treasure hunting that we might associate with Indiana Jones, but it quickly settled into the disciplined pursuit of knowledge about cultures from the past, as these cultures reveal themselves in the objects they created and the structures they built. Archaeologists created the idea of the discrete culture that could be identified by groups of artifacts occurring together. If you find certain kinds of pots, certain kinds of weapons, and certain kinds of personal objects, like jewelry, together in a region, you're probably looking at people who considered themselves to belong to the same ethnic group. That's the theory that archaeologists developed, and it proved very influential in the creation of the idea of the Celts. Archaeology is very important, particularly to the study of the ancient Celts, because very, very little written material has survived from the Celts themselves. But the drawback of archaeology is precisely the fact that the artifacts cannot talk. We can't be sure from looking at pots or brooches what languages their owners spoke or what ethnic groups they considered themselves to be members of. And we're also limited by what has happened to survive and what archaeologists have happened to find. But we're also going to talk about a brand new kind of evidence, DNA evidence. Scientists can now do two kinds of DNA analysis that can help us understand the ancient Celts. They can analyze the DNA of bones preserved in ancient burials, and they can also analyze the DNA of living persons to help them understand something about where different populations came from and how they are related to each other. Is there something distinctive genetically about the Celtic regions? How does DNA shed light on some of the big questions about Celtic identity? So we'll be covering a lot of ground in this course, from ancient texts to the latest scientific advances, and all of it will help us to understand the world of the Celts. We'll start in our next lecture by looking in detail at what happened when the Greeks and the Romans met the Celts for the first time.
Lecture 2, The Celts and the Classical World.
Welcome back. In this lecture, we're going to encounter the Celts mostly through the eyes of the Greeks and Romans who wrote about them 2,000 and more years ago. The reason we have to rely on Greek and Roman authors is that we don't have very much information about the ancient Celts that was actually written by the Celts themselves, other than a few mostly fragmentary inscriptions. The reason why is quite interesting. We're told that the Druids, who were the intellectuals of the Celtic world, did not believe in writing. They thought that writing things down made people go soft in the head. If you didn't have to make the effort to remember things, then how could you say you really knew them? There was also a kind of trade secret issue going on here. The Druids wanted to monopolize sacred lore. But if they wrote it down, perhaps people on the outside could get access to it. Now, other reports suggest that the Druids did write things down, but that they kept them secret. And unfortunately, they kept them so secret that they're secret from us now. Thus, almost all of the written texts that we have about the ancient Celts were written by the Greeks and Romans who encountered them. And until relatively recently, everything people knew about the ancient Celts came from the texts we'll be talking about in this lecture. But keep in mind that we will be talking here mostly about how the Celts appeared to outsiders. The story of the encounter between the Celts and the classical world is fascinating because Greek and Roman writers had various reactions to the Celts depending on what they were trying to achieve in the different texts they wrote. Sometimes the Celts appear as barbaric warriors who threaten the survival of classical civilization. Sometimes they are noble savages whose high ethical standards present a stark contrast with the degraded manners of contemporary Romans. Sometimes they are merely curiosities exhibited to an interested reading public. There are other factors we have to keep in mind as well. One is how much these authors actually knew about the Celts. Some of the authors we'll talk about knew a lot. They actually traveled to the territories where the Celts lived. In fact, we know that several ancient writers undertook very extensive travels, both by land and by sea, and we'll talk about those. It helps a lot that both the Greeks and the Romans established colonies all around the Mediterranean, so they actually came into contact with Celts on their borders quite a bit. But other writers had less first-hand knowledge of the people they wrote about, and in some cases they merely recycled stories they had heard or read elsewhere. So we have to be cautious in using these authors. Another problem we have is that many of these texts about the ancient Celts survive only in fragmentary form. It was very common in the ancient world for writers to take works written by various earlier authors and copy the most interesting passages into a new work. In some cases, this process could lead to the original, longer work going out of fashion, and if it stopped being copied, it might be lost entirely. As a result, in some cases, we have bits and pieces of what people wrote about the Celts, but we don't necessarily have the whole thing. So it's possible that we're getting only the greatest hits, perhaps the most lurid, interesting stories, and not the more day-to-day information that modern scholars would actually really love to have. So this is a second issue we have to keep in mind. Nevertheless, with all of these potential shortcomings, we're very lucky to have quite a bit of information about the ancient Celts that was written down by people who actually knew them or knew of them. So we're going to talk in this lecture about some of these authors who wrote about the Celts. But before we do, let's tackle a question that's quite important to our subject. The question of the name Celt and where it comes from. There is no easy answer to this question. We know that the word Celt was first used by the Greeks to refer to the peoples who lived in Gaul, just north of the Greek colony at Massalia, which is now the French city of Marseille. The earliest author who used the word Celt was a man called Hecataeus of Miletus, who described these peoples in 517 BC. Hecataeus is one of those authors whose work we know only through extracts that were written down by later authors. The Greeks tended to call these people the Celtoi, with a K, ever afterwards. But we don't really know what the word Celt refers to. There are various theories. Some linguists think the word means to hide, but others think it means to strike or to impel. So those are pretty different ideas. It could mean foreigners, which is actually a very common way that one people refers to another. Or it could mean the tall ones. The Celts were often described as being taller than the Greeks or Romans, so that would fit, but we're just not sure. Then we have the problem of what the Romans called the Celts. Some of them just took over the word Celtoi from the Greeks and Latinized it as Celti with a C. But most Roman authors referred to these people as Galli or Gauls. We're not sure if this was originally a name that these people gave to themselves, or perhaps it was a name that a particular tribe gave to itself. We know that in the 3rd century, the Greeks called the people who invaded Asia Minor the Galatai, which is clearly related to the Galli. This word may have, as its root, a word that means warlike, and it may be related to the word that the Irish later used to refer to themselves, the Gaels. So we have these two different terms for the people that we're talking about, the Celts and the Gauls, and for now, we're not going to be able to choose between them or to explain their origins very precisely. So let's just use the terms fairly interchangeably and not worry too much about it. One thing we should also say is that just as we don't know the origin of the word Celt, we don't know what the ancient authors meant when they used the word Celt. Who were they talking about? They were not necessarily working from a consistent definition of what a Celt was. And we're pretty sure that they were not checking to see if the people they called Celts were speaking a Celtic language, because the concept of the Celtic languages as a family of languages related to each other didn't exist in the classical period. I will talk about the discovery of the relationship between the Celtic languages in another lecture. Sometimes these authors do note that a particular people spoke a language that was similar to some other language, but these people were not historical linguists. They could not apply a sort of linguistic litmus test to decide if someone was or was not a Celt. Probably, they're going much more on descriptions of similar customs. They're probably diagnosing Celticness more the way of an anthropologist than the way of a linguist, using social customs rather than language. But all of these definitions and criteria are a bit vague. One point to repeat here, though, before we go on, at the risk of beating a dead horse, is the fact that the ancient writers never referred to any residents of the British Isles or Ireland as Celts. We'll come back to this point in the future, and we'll try to decide how much it matters to the question of defining who the Celts are. So, now that we have a lot of preliminaries out of the way, let's talk about what some of these ancient authors had to say about the Celts. First, we'll talk about what the classical authors thought they knew about the Celts as a people, where they lived, and what they were like. Then we'll talk in more detail about relations between the Celts on the one hand and the Greeks and the Romans on the other, all along what we might think of as the frontier between their two worlds. We have some very vague indications, clustered about the time of Hecataeus of Miletus in the middle of the first millennium BC, that a people known as the Celts was believed to live in the north and west of Europe. The only thing that's clear about these early references is that these authors did not have the geography very straight at all. For example, the famous Greek historian Herodotus does not seem to be sure whether the Celts lived at the source of the Danube River or beyond the Pillars of Hercules, that is, beyond the Straits of Gibraltar. So he's not sure if the Celts come from Central Europe or from the western Atlantic coast of Europe. Some of these authors had a good excuse for their geographical confusion, namely the fact that they never really traveled to the supposed lands of the Celts at all. They were clearly going on rumors that they had picked up, rather than on actual first-hand information. But we do know that some travelers did venture into Celtic territory, and we have some tantalizing hints of what they found. For example, we have a very interesting poem called the Ora Maritima, or Sea Coasts, which was written in the 4th century AD by a poet named Avienus. Avienus claimed that the poem was based on the Massaliote Periplus, a text from the 6th century BC that lists the major ports and landmarks that a sailor could expect to encounter in the region around Massalia. The poem probably also contains information compiled by a Carthaginian author named Himilco that was based on a description of a Carthaginian voyage of exploration undertaken around 500 BC. Now, if these ancient authors were only vaguely sure of where the Celts came from, they were pretty sure they were up to no good. Fairly early on in the history of writing about the Celts, they got associated with certain traits that stigmatized them as barbarians. Aristotle, for instance, criticized the Celts for having a kind of crazed fearlessness, and he also reported disapprovingly on their predilection for homosexual relationships. Now, for a Greek to criticize the Celts for homosexuality is a bit much, I think. Greek elite society was very tolerant of homosexual relationships. And I'm not sure Aristotle really had accurate information about the sexual mores of the Celts. It's very easy for outsiders to get this sort of thing wrong, and it's extremely common to assume that the sex lives of other people are more noteworthy than one's own. Aristotle's teacher, Plato, criticized the Celts for drunkenness, and this cultural habit does seem to have been one of the aspects of Celtic society that classical commentators noticed the most. We will talk about alcohol and the Celts in a later lecture. But the Celts were not all about indulging in the pleasures of the flesh without limit. One of my favorite Celtic stories comes from the so-called Histories of Epirus, which was probably written in the early to mid 4th century BC, but it's preserved only by later writers. Epirus claims that Celtic warriors had to pass a kind of fitness test by demonstrating that they had not put on too much weight. Every village had a standard-sized belt, and if warriors could put on the belt and buckle it, they were good to go. But if they couldn't buckle it, they had to go on a diet until they had lost enough weight to buckle it again. I kind of hope this story is true. It's nice to imagine a whole village of fierce warriors lining up for their regular weigh-in. Perhaps my second favorite story about the Celts comes from an account of an embassy of Celts from the Adriatic that supposedly caught up with Alexander the Great in 335 BC. Apparently, the great man was impressed by their fearlessness. And so he asked if there was anything whatsoever that they actually feared. They replied, "Only that the sky should fall on our heads." Now, I think this was probably supposed to be kind of a joke, meaning, nah, there's nothing that we fear. I mean, the sky falling on us, ha, that's it. But this story was taken literally, and it went into the stock of tales about the Celts. People everywhere thought the Celts were afraid of the sky falling on them, and you see it pop up again and again. And it even appears in the wonderful modern French comic Astérix, which purports to describe the life of a Gaulish village during the Roman occupation of Gaul. We'll talk much more about Astérix later in the course. Now, I want to mention just one more early story about the Celts here, because it touches on the very important topic of early Celtic religion that we will discuss at greater length later on. An early writer named Hieronymus of Cardia reports that the Celts lived on the edge of the ocean, presumably meaning the Atlantic coast, and that they practiced human sacrifice. This is actually a very controversial topic, but for now, just keep in mind that these stories did circulate in the classical world. The Celts were definitely seen as intimidating and exotic. One of the most important writers who talked about the Celts was a man named Posidonius, who was known as the athlete. We're not sure why. Posidonius was famous as a polymath, which means he knew a little bit about everything. He calculated the circumference of the earth by comparing the position of the star Canopus above the horizon in Alexandria to its position in Rhodes. He was determined to learn about the Celts for himself, so he actually got on a ship in the eastern Mediterranean and went west to explore. He ended up traveling north from Massalia, or Marseille, into the heart of Gaul, and he wrote up his findings in a work which unfortunately survives only in extracts. The work of Posidonius is fundamental to our understanding of the Celts, and the stories he told became a kind of template that other authors would refer back to. Julius Caesar, for example, would rely on Posidonius extensively. Posidonius is the first writer to note that the Celts displayed the severed heads of their enemies. The cult of the severed head really struck people in the classical world as noteworthy, which should not surprise us. He also has some of the most extensive information about the fighting techniques of the Celts. Supposedly, they liked to fight naked. Caesar notes that they also treated their hair with a kind of paste made of lime to make it stand up on end, which made them look quite intimidating to their opponents. They also played loud war trumpets, and they were given to challenging their enemies to single combat. This warrior's challenge was not confined to the battlefield. Posidonius reports that when the Celts were feasting, their natural boastfulness would often get out of hand, and then they would challenge each other to a fight, and the winner would receive the choicest portion of the meat. The competition for the so-called hero's portion was another aspect of Celtic society that really captured the imaginations of classical readers. These feasts were also said to be characterized by the presence of bards, who recited a lot of poetry in praise of their chieftains. One last favorite story about the Celts that probably comes from Posidonius's lost text. The Celts are described as tall and blonde, and it is noted that their children have gray hair when they are young, which then gets darker. I think this is a reference to the well-known phenomenon among light-skinned people where children's hair can be very blonde when they're little and then turns brown. I myself, though now a deep brunette, used to be flaxen blonde. It's interesting to think about these Greeks and Romans, who perhaps had a more typically Mediterranean complexion, coming across these very fair-skinned, fair-haired Celts, and imagining that their hair traveled a kind of reverse path from gray hair in childhood to dark hair in adulthood. So now that we've gotten some information out there about some of the general characteristics that the classical authors attributed to the Celts, let's talk a little about their encounter with the classical world. In this lecture, we're going to talk about three regions where the Celts met up with their classical counterparts. First Italy, then Greece, then Spain. And this order roughly reflects the chronology of when the Romans and Greeks went up against the Celts militarily. Let's start with the Italian peninsula, where Celts were an important presence for as far back as we have written sources to go on. There seem to have been Celtic speakers in northern Italy from very early on. In fact, some of the earliest Celtic inscriptions we have are from northern Italy, from the people we know as the Lepanti. The Lepanti apparently spoke a language related to Gaulish or Gallic. They lived in the area just north of Milan, around the great Italian lakes. This is where the Lepantic inscriptions have been found, dating from as early as 550 BC. They're written in a northern Italian script related to Etruscan, and they seem to have been, these people, very much a part of the landscape. They're not invaders. They had just always been there. But there were other groups of Celtic speakers who seem to have appeared in northern Italy around 400 BC, probably attracted by the wealth and the wine of the Italian peninsula. They conquered the northern Italian plains, and that means they were conquering other Celtic speakers. And then they moved south on Rome. The Roman historian Livy, writing around the turn of the 1st century BC and the 1st century AD, tells us that in 390 BC, they sacked the city, or at least most of it. I've already told the story of the massacre of the elderly Roman senators, but supposedly the Capitoline Hill was saved from attack when the sacred geese, dedicated to Juno, sounded the alarm. Historians don't believe this. In reality, it's clear even from Livy that the Celts had to be bribed to go away. Modern scholars have now even cast doubt on whether the sack of Rome by the Gauls happened in the way that Livy describes. They note that another historian named Polybius, who was writing in the 2nd century BC, much closer to the events that Livy writes about, does not mention the Gaulish attack on Rome. But the story gets at a larger truth, which is that the Gauls of northern Italy were seen as a threat for a very long time. Finally, in 225 BC, a Celtic army was defeated by the Romans at the Battle of Telamon in Tuscany, north of Rome. And this was really the end of the Celts as an independent power in the north of Italy. From this point on, the Romans spoke about two Gauls, which were distinguished by their position with respect to the Alps. One Gaul was on the Italian side of the Alps. It was called Cisalpine Gaul, from the Latin word cis, which means on this side of. The other Gaul was called Transalpine Gaul, because it was across or on the other side of the Alps. So Cisalpine Gaul, the Italian part of Gaul, was now under Roman domination. But for now, Transalpine Gaul was something the Romans had no interest in reckoning with. We'll be coming back to it in a later lecture. Although the first people to write about the Celts were Greeks, these writers were not based in Greece itself, but rather in the Greek colonies of the Western Mediterranean, such as Massalia. It was only many years after the dramatic events in Rome in 390 BC that the first Celts actually encroached on the territory of Greece itself. I'd like to pause here for just a moment to discuss the Greek view of outsiders, whom they regarded as barbarians. The Greeks may not have invented the concept of the barbarian. Many cultures have an aversion towards foreigners, but the Greeks did invent the actual word barbarian. Our word barbarian comes from the Greek encounter with other peoples. The Greeks thought that non-Greek speech sounded like bar, bar, bar. So they named a person who spoke a language other than Greek a barbaros. Then the Romans adopted the word, though to them it was someone who spoke anything other than Greek or Latin. So what happened between the Celts and the Greeks? In the early 3rd century BC, large groups of barbarians swept into Greece from the north. They were taking advantage of the collapse of the empire of Alexander the Great, who had died in 323 BC. In 281 BC, a group of people known to the Greeks as the Galatai, and later as the Galatians, defeated the Macedonian king Ptolemy. They then split into two main groups. One group, under a leader named Brennus, headed south in 279 BC towards the temple at Delphi, which was a tempting target because it basically functioned as a big bank. Apparently, the Greek gods, especially Pan, intervened to foil the attack by inducing panic among the invaders, who then retreated in great disorder. And their leader Brennus, in shame, committed suicide. According to one report, he took his own life by drinking undiluted wine. The Greeks had had a lucky escape, but they were very glad to see the back of these people. So that was the end of one of the two groups of Celts. The other group headed into central Turkey, where they founded their own state. Let's spend just a few minutes talking about what happened next, because it's a fascinating side note to the main story of the Celts. The Galatians actually wound up in Turkey by invitation. At that time, present-day Turkey was divided up into many smaller states that were often at war with each other. The ruler of one of these states, the Kingdom of Bithynia, invited the Galatians in to serve as mercenaries. And incidentally, this phenomenon was by no means an isolated one. We have reports of other bands of Celtic mercenaries in other parts of the classical world, including in Egypt, where they were referred to as wild Celts, and in Macedonia. But let's go back to our Galatians in Bithynia. They didn't manage to defeat the king's enemies, but they did manage to carve out a stronghold for themselves in the interior of Turkey. And they made their living basically as bandits. They had a very desperate reputation. They were known for sacrificing their victims, so people would kill themselves rather than face capture by the Galatians. These were good people to have inside the tent rather than outside, So various rulers hired them as mercenaries over the years, including people who were resisting the eventual Roman conquest of Turkey. So these were some very fierce warriors, and given the reputation of the Galatians, it's no wonder that when people did manage to defeat the Galatians, they wanted people to know about it. We have evidence for this in a remarkable statue that is usually called the Dying Gaul,